Today is Thursday, March 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The United States tells NATO that the way forward is together.
We are much stronger and much more effective than if any single one of us is doing it alone.
Plus, Myanmar's junta frees hundreds of prisoners.
There was no immediate word from authorities on how many prisoners were freed.
And a look at the stress Brazil's hospitals face under the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll have these stories and more next. North Korea launched at least two projectiles suspected of being ballistic missiles Thursday. That's according to officials in South Korea, Japan, and the United States. It marks the first such test reported since U.S. President Joe Biden took office in January. North Korea's ballistic missiles are banned under United Nations Security Council resolutions, and if the launch is confirmed, it would represent a new challenge to Biden's efforts to engage with Pyongyang, which have so far been rebuffed. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told NATO members on Wednesday that the way forward was together.
When we are speaking with one voice, when we're acting together, we are much stronger and much more effective than if any single one of us is doing it alone.
Blinken said the United States will not force any NATO ally to choose sides between Washington and Beijing as the United States and China vie for supremacy in areas from electric cars to biomedicine.
There's no question that Beijing's coercive behavior threatens our collective security and prosperity, and that it is actively working to undercut the rules of the international system and the values we and our allies share. But that doesn't mean that countries can't work with China where possible, for example, on challenges like climate change and health security.
And after a meeting with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, Blinken said the United States will work closely with our allies and our European Union partners across the continent to address our shared challenges. The 21-year-old suspect in this week's Colorado mass shooting will make his first court appearance on Thursday, 3 days after authorities say he opened fire at a supermarket and killed 10 people, including a policeman. Reuters reporter Chris Dignam.
Music and a makeshift memorial for the 10 victims of Colorado's latest mass shooting materialized at the site of Monday's massacre in Boulder, where mourners laid flowers and notes at the fence surrounding King Soopers grocery store. Another memorial sprang up at Boulder Police Headquarters in honor of Eric Talley, a father of seven and the first officer to respond to the scene, who died in the attack. It was the second deadly U.S. mass shooting in a week after eight people were killed at day spas in Georgia, prompting calls for Congress to strengthen gun restrictions. Generations of Coloradans have seen similar memorials erected for the dead. This week's bloodshed added to the state's tragic list of mass killings that include some of the most shocking episodes of gun violence in U.S. history, including the 2012 mass shooting at a movie theater in Aurora and the 1999 rampage at Columbine High School. Police were searching for clues on Wednesday into what led 21-year-old Ahmad al-Aliwi Alisa, a naturalized U.S. citizen from Syria who graduated from Arvada West High School in 2018, to open fire at the Boulder supermarket. Alisa pleaded guilty to third-degree assault for punching a classmate in late 2017. The classmate said the attack was unprovoked. Alisa told an officer the classmate had called him a terrorist and racist names. The suspect's 34-year-old brother described him as antisocial and paranoid in an interview with the Daily Beast. His sister-in-law told police that he had been playing with a firearm resembling a machine gun 2 days before the rampage, upsetting family members, according to an arrest affidavit. Police have not yet publicly identified a motive for the killings. Alisa is scheduled to make his first court appearance on Thursday.
Reuters' Chris Dignam. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security is considering expanding efforts to monitor possible domestic terrorism threats through surveillance of travel patterns of individuals. U.S. Representative Elisa Slotkin says the attack on the U.S. Capitol building January 6, as well as additional warnings from law enforcement, make it clear that threats remain.
For some people, the division that's rife in our country right now will lead them to climb that ladder of escalation use violence or the threat of violence for political goals and become domestic terrorists. Taking on this threat is our top priority.
Precise details are unclear on how the DHS is going to step up screening of domestic travelers for possible extremist ties or intentions. The Biden administration has emphasized in recent weeks the threat that homegrown violent individuals, including white supremacists, present to the country. The humanitarian group Doctors Without Borders says that its staff saw Ethiopian government troops shooting and killing four men who were taken off a civilian bus on a road in the embattled region of Tigray. The group said in a statement that the killings on Tuesday followed the apparent ambush of an Ethiopian military convoy by an armed group. There was no immediate reaction from the Ethiopian government. UN spokesperson Stephane Dujarric said the Human Rights Office has had a request from the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission for an investigation into alleged abuses.
And I can tell you that our colleagues at the UN Office for Human Rights have received a request from the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission for joint investigation into allegations of serious human rights violations by all sides in Tigray. The Human Rights Office has responded positively, and we're in the process of putting in place plans for a joint investigation.
Myanmar's junta freed hundreds of demonstrators arrested during its brutal crackdown on protests Wednesday. Reuters' Emily Wither has this update.
They streamed out by the busload from a jail in Myanmar's city of Yangon. Hundreds of demonstrators arrested during the country's brutal crackdown were released Wednesday by the ruling military junta. There was no immediate word from authorities on how many prisoners were freed. An activist group called the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners says at least 2,000 people have been arrested since protests erupted following the coup in February. The prisoners were stepping out onto streets that were largely deserted because other demonstrators were trying a new tactic, a silent strike. In the country's biggest city, Yangon, many businesses remained closed.
I am not going out anywhere or participating in any ways that would disturb the silent strike. We feel courageous because we see that the action of the military council has suffered from the silent strike. Our belief in our revolution prevailing will strengthen if we are all united. That's why our spring revolution must prevail.
The strike comes a day after the bloody crackdown saw its youngest victim laid to rest, a 7-year-old girl. Her father explained what happened after security forces broke into their house. His daughter was sat on his lap.
They asked, "Is there anyone else?" and fired the gunshot while saying, "Don't lie to us, old man." They shot her as she leaned towards my chest. I ran and was carrying her and could not even look at the security forces after she was shot.
The military had no immediate comment on the incident. About 275 people have been killed in the bloody protests, according to the activist group. The Myanmar office of the UN's Children Agency says at least 23 of the dead are children. Military leaders have promised a new election, but have not set a date and have declared a state of emergency.
Emily Wither reports for Reuters News. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. With most of the votes counted, Israelis still don't know who won Tuesday's election. So far, neither Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu or the main challenger, Yair Lapid, has a way to put together a majority coalition. That means there will be weeks of political horse trading and possibly another election. Linda Gradstein has the details.
It's going to take a while until Israelis know the final results of Tuesday's election, the fourth in 2 years. Yaron Dekel is a longtime journalist in Israel and has covered many elections.
We don't have a bottom line, unfortunately, because the counting still continues. And we'll probably have the final results by Friday morning or afternoon.
That's because there are more than 450,000 special ballots from Israeli soldiers, hospital patients, and diplomats overseas that have yet to be counted. And since Israel is such a small country, even a few thousand votes can swing a parliamentary seat. There are several possible scenarios once the vote counting is done, says Dekel. The first is that Netanyahu, with the help of several ultra-Orthodox and hardline parties like Yamina, headed by former Netanyahu aide Naftali Bennett, puts together a coalition.
The first one is the easy one. Mr. Netanyahu plus Mr. Bennett both have together over 61 seats. Mr. Netanyahu is likely to form his sixth government, because if this is the case, I believe that Mr. Bennett will have one option to join Mr. Netanyahu, and that's it.
Another scenario, he says, is that nobody is able to form a coalition, meaning Israel would go to a fifth election. Yet another less likely possibility is that all of those who oppose Netanyahu band together to put together a coalition. The chance that Arab members of parliament would join a government, even a centrist one, seems unlikely. Israeli analysts said Israel's fast COVID-19 vaccine program, which has already reached 80% of Israel's adults, worked in Netanyahu's favor. The fact that he is currently on trial for corruption has not affected his support, which remains similar to the past three elections. Netanyahu appeared happy when he went to vote.
He
said it is a holiday and that Israelis are going out in so many ways, referring to Israel's recent emergence from a series of lockdowns and a sharp improvement in the coronavirus situation. Several new parties will be in the next government. The first is a surprise achievement by Abbas Mansour, an Arab member of parliament who broke from the Arab joint list and appears to have received five seats. Another is a new extremist party called Religious Zionism that won six seats and will be part of Netanyahu's coalition if he manages to form one. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
And in the latest COVID news, Brazil is emerging as the world's worst hit country. A scientist warned that a fast-acting spreading variant called P1 may be one of the world's most dangerous. Edgar Maciel takes it from here.
These images are recorded from a party this week during a night in São Paulo. Young people without masks, clustering, enjoying music with no sign of a pandemic. Scenes like these are repeated in Brazil since the first wave of the pandemic passed. Cases decrease, deaths fell, and Brazilian people returned to what they thought would be a new normal. This is the São Paulo metro at the start of this week, as Brazil registered more than 290,000 deaths. There is no space or social distance. Experts say it's a recipe for disaster in a country that is a major world exporter of goods and services.
O Brasil está vivendo uma catástrofe.
Brazil is experiencing a catastrophe. In the last few days, more than 23% of all deaths per day in the world are happening here, and we only have 2.7% of the world population. Brazilian situation today is a threat to global public health. If international governments and WHO do not turn their attention to Brazil, we can cause a catastrophe for the whole world.
Brazil has 27 federative entities, and 26 of them, hospitals and health centers are almost collapsing. In the south of Brazil, VOA visit Porto Alegre, capital of Rio Grande do Sul state. The system here has been overcrowded for 23 days in a row. People are getting sick and dying without any treatment. Doctors don't know what to do to save patients. It's the worst moment of the pandemic.
We're in a very difficult scenario because we don't know exactly what awaits us. Each day looks worse than the last.
São Paulo, Brazil's largest city, is on the same path. 9 out of 10 intensive care units are already occupied, the highest level of the pandemic. A large number of sick patients have been dying without being seen by a doctor. Outside hospitals, day and night, families wait for days for any news.
Trouxe minha esposa aqui pro hospital ontem.
I brought my wife here to the hospital. I don't know how she is. I ask God that she get out of this, but it's hard. I feel very upset. It's a virus that is decimating families. My father, my sister, my son and my wife, all of them with COVID.
Trying to contain the chaos, São Paulo and other capitals around the country decided to close business, but it hasn't worked. Much of the population is not staying home. Many people still need to go out to work. It is a difficult decision in a country that is fighting poverty daily. The choice is protect yourself or go hungry.
It's been very difficult for people who work on the street. People criticize me, but I'm here because I need to be. I have no other income. I have to pay my rent every month. If I stay at home, I either die of the coronavirus or I starve to death. It's not easy.
For many, the blame points to the country's capital and its leadership for not investing enough in vaccines and managing the crisis better.
A culpa é do treinador.
When the team is bad, it's the coach's fault. So here in Brazil, the top leader of the nation is to blame. In addition to not helping, the president has hindered the fight against coronavirus. Bolsonaro was the one who said the pandemic was ending. He said, so what? And it was just a little flu. It was the president who started spreading false information about medicines and said the vaccination was not safe.
President Jair Bolsonaro has said the country has done all it can in the face of the pandemic and criticized lockdown measures, saying they do even more harm to the economic than the virus. In the meantime, Bolsonaro has signed measures to speed up the purchase of more vaccines. Edgar Maciel for VOA News, São Paulo.
A year ago, India imposed one of the world's strictest lockdowns, resulting in an exodus of millions of domestic migrant workers from its crowded cities. In recent months, many have returned. Some are finding jobs in an economy that is slowly recovering from its worst fall in decades, but others are still struggling. Anjana Pasricha reports.
These migrant workers were among millions who trekked hundreds of kilometers to their village homes after Indian cities abruptly shuttered a year ago to stave off the COVID-19 pandemic. Others scrambled to get on to buses. The mass exodus of migrants stranded without jobs and money sparked a humanitarian crisis. Life in villages was not easy either.
I used to break stones from a small hill close by to sell to people building homes. That's how I managed to get by.
I tried to find something that would yield an income and sustain the family, but I could do nothing due to the lockdown.
India's months-long shutdown led to mass unemployment in a country where rural migrants sustain the big city economy, working as drivers, construction labor, rickshaw pullers, or at street stalls, among other things. This vast, unorganized sector accounts for more than 90% of the country's livelihoods.
That's why it's only in India, out of the major economies, that you saw mass migration from urban to rural areas. You didn't see this mass migration taking place in the US or in UK or in China, etc., because they don't have such a large unorganized sector. And the unorganized sector doesn't have the kind of poverty that it is there in India. That's why India was particularly hard hit.
India's worst economic crisis brought more hardship than war, says Kumar.
What happens in war is that everybody is busy fighting the war, producing for the war, etc. But here, because people are not working, you know, so unemployment is there. And that's why the economy dropped very sharply.
As cities reopen, many people have returned to search for livelihoods. But the pandemic has changed cities. Kamal Singh sold his cab. The new norm of working from home meant he got very few customers.
I used to roam around 100 to 150 kilometers a day, but get few rides, and the money I earned barely covered my expenses on the cab.
Some have been luckier. Jobs are returning as the economy recovers. Yadav was employed 2 months ago at a food counter.
Now everything is good. I have even returned the loans I took.
But the pandemic's scars run deep.
I'm always fearful that suppose another such problem comes. How will I manage, especially if my family increases? This really troubles me.
That question has acquired new urgency as some parts of India grapple with the second wave. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
The year-long pandemic has also brought about another problem, pollution. AP correspondent Rita Foley has that part of today's pandemic coverage.
The disposable masks, gloves, and other items that protect us from COVID-19 are also creating a worldwide pollution problem, according to environmentalists. Littering streets and sending harmful plastic and other waste into landfills, sewage systems, and oceans. The Marine Mammals Center, a conservation group that rescues mammals, says animals can get trapped in those items or mistake them for food. One small thing you can do, says a spokesman, cut the loops on your mask before throwing it out. It can help prevent animals from getting tangled in them. And here's an eye-popper. An advocacy group predicts more than 1.5 billion masks flooded oceans in 2020 alone. And they say masks can take 450 years to break down. I'm Rita Foley.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. This year, a Truth and Justice Commission, the first of its kind in Australia, will examine the impact of colonization on Aboriginal people in the state of Victoria. Phil Mercer has that story.
The commission will be modelled on a similar process established in South Africa after the collapse of apartheid and others in New Zealand and Canada. In South Africa, a reconciliation body was set up by Nelson Mandela. It was similar to a court where witnesses and victims could freely express their grievances and experiences during apartheid. The system of enforced racial segregation was in place in South Africa between 1948 and 1990. Unlike other nations, Australia has never formally examined the full impact of past policies on its original inhabitants. The Victorian state government has said now was the time for a proper examination of colonisation on Aboriginal Australians. They lost their land when British settlers arrived in 1788 and have suffered injustices ever since. During the early years of colonisation, Indigenous people were massacred by Europeans, incarcerated, and forcibly removed from their customary land. Today, their life expectancy is lower compared to other groups in Australia. While rates of poverty, ill health, unemployment and imprisonment are far higher. The commission will have broad powers and will be able to compel witnesses to give evidence. Victoria has committed to signing a treaty with its Aboriginal communities. Victoria's Deputy Premier James Merlino says a truth commission is an important part in that process.
This is long overdue. It's an acknowledgement that the pain in our past is present in the lives of people right now. It's a recognition that without truth, without justice, you can't have a treaty. You can't take that incredibly powerful step forward until we go through this process of truth and justice.
Indigenous leaders and state officials said after 233 years of violence and dispossession, they're committed to telling the truth. Auntie Geraldine Atkinson is an Aboriginal elder.
All those truths need to be told. The truths our elders had to endure, that our ancestors endured. Genocide, massacres, a whole range of truths that needs to be told.
The majority of the panel of five commissioners will be Aboriginal. Their task will be to record an accurate account of Victoria's history of colonisation and scrutinise both past and present injustices. Its report is expected next year. Indigenous Australians make up about 3% of the population. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And finally, the United States Peace Corps turned 60 this year, and VOA's Mariama Diallo has this look at the International Volunteer Organization to promote peace and friendship.
vision was born 6 decades ago. Former President John F. Kennedy outlined the program and prospects of young Americans going abroad to not only serve shoulder to shoulder with citizens of other countries, but also learn from them.
What is remarkable is that there is no salary for the members of the Peace Corps. They will go abroad and live on the same standard as people of other countries, but they will work with them 2 or 3 years, devoting part of their lives to peace and to strengthening the ties that bind men together all over the globe.
It was an audacious idea at the time, some said, but fast forward 60 years, the idea has been realized, says John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum Director Alan Price.
It's been a fantastic idea, thanks to the hard work of volunteers and the hard work of host countries. I think that the goal has a long-term strategy to promote peace and friendship has been largely successful.
In the past 60 years, about 241,000 Peace Corps volunteers have served in more than 140 countries worldwide, says Peace Corps Acting Director Carol Spahn, who also noted a variety in the ages of participants.
Peace Corps volunteers range in age from 20 to 85. The bulk of them, tend to be in their 20s. But when I was serving as country director in Malawi, we had one of the oldest serving volunteers at that time. She was 82 years old and just a pistol. She was terrific.
Spahn was 26 when she decided to serve in the Peace Corps in Romania. It was 3 years after the fall of communism. Some people were suspicious, she says, but it was a life-changing experience for her.
What happens with many volunteers is you go into Peace Corps with a certain worldview or some expectations of why things are the way they are. And as you live and work with people that are different from yourselves, you start to ask questions. And when you go in with curiosity, you learn what's behind why things maybe happen differently than they do in your own country, or why people hold certain values, and what that history is.
Dwayne Matthews is also a returnee who spent time in Malawi from 2013 to 2015. He now works for the Department of Housing and Urban Development and is pursuing a PhD program at Washington's Howard University. He's from Little Rock, Arkansas, and had never traveled abroad before.
When I got to Malawi, it was a complete culture shock. That first week or so was terrifying, but then by the time I was leaving Peace Corps, I actually broke down in tears because I had to leave. So it was the best choice I made in my young adult life up to that point.
The youth in Malawi don't have a voice.
While there, he served as a community health advisor who worked on many projects. One of his proudest is securing a nearly $7,000 grant to help build a youth center, a project the community also contributed to, he said.
The community, they actually donated like 30% of what we needed. So the community donated the land, they donated some of the labor, they donated some of the bricks and quarry stone. We actually had money remaining because of the community contribution, which is how we knew this project was going to be sustainable because, the community wanted it.
Christopher Destish served in Guatemala from 2018 to 2020. He's now a regional recruiter for the Peace Corps.
I lived in a small Mayan community. There's about 2,000 people in the community that I was in. And I lived with a 3-generation indigenous Mayan family, which was really awesome. Very chaotic, but very loving.
While there, he says, he partnered with the Guatemalan Ministry of Agriculture to implement their rural extension program.
So basically, I was working with them to give trainings to increase the capacity of rural Mayan farmers. The objective was to increase their capacity to grow food and thereby decrease things like food insecurity, malnutrition, and hunger.
Both Matthews and Destish say they've learned life lessons and skills they wouldn't have had they not served in the Peace Corps. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.